Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have as my guest today, Dr. Nilma Chitkopekar, who is an associate professor in the Department of History at Jesus and Mary College at Delhi University. We're actually talking about a Penguin Books publication, The Reluctant Family Man. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Raj. Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So the subtitle may give a clue as to what the book's about. It's the Reluctant Family Man, Shiva in Everyday Life. What kind of book is this? What is this book about?
Well, I don't know. Penguin was trying to say that they were going to put it in the category of self-help. And I said, that just sounds so cheesy. And they said, no, we won't do that. We'll just keep it, with mythology and, life-helping kind of books. And I don't know what category they put it into, but it has a lot of mythology and it has a lot of guidelines how to lead a life which would be more satisfying. I'm not saying happy, but, just certain rules and, whatever,
So the premise of the book is looking to mythologies of Shiva and deriving insights for human life therefrom, correct?
That's right, Raj. Absolutely. That's exactly what it's about. Yeah.
Now, I have a number of guests on this podcast. Primarily, the podcast is catered towards scholarship or new books in the field, various methodologies and subfields. It just so happens that I also study Hindu mythology. And many of my private courses deal with looking to mythological narratives for insight on human life. So here we are. You're preaching to the choir, at least in this case. But tell us a little bit about what on earth you mean, ancient Indian mythology and human life. Why are those things connected? What are you talking about?
Well, I've spent a lifetime absolutely fascinated by the myths that I've been reading. I basically am a Puranic scholar, if you could call me that. And I have been studying the Purans and the myths therein for a very long time. And I just felt it was time that, actually it's not time, it started more than 10 years ago, that I wanted to, relate these myths to people from all kinds of walks of life, not just academia. So that's how it all started about 11 years ago in 2010, actually. We made films. There was a young entrepreneur and he wanted me to, make films on me talking about Shiva. And that's how it all started. Those films were sold worldwide. It was his business. And I was just made the main, I was the only contributor actually to begin with. And I was very hesitant, Raj. I have to tell you, that was the time when, I thought that I was, letting down my academic circles by doing something. I thought it was cheesy, tacky, you name it. But he's a very dear friend of my son's, and he insisted. And, I'm so glad I did it eventually. Let's put it like that.
Well, I know that feeling so, so well. I think listeners of the podcast may have heard this before, but I ended up defending in 2015, and it was a perfect storm. Shortly thereafter, certain election results rolled out. The job market is not great whatsoever. It's not that one can't get the job, it's that the jobs don't exist. And so I ended up, out of dire necessity, marketing to the public, sharing courses. This is my primary livelihood to this day. So I've managed to be a fairly productive, essentially independent scholar. And at this point, it's so, to me, it's so meaningful and fruitful to bridge the world of ancient Indian myth in modern Western life. Irrespective of what my academic path looks like in future, this will stay with me. It's part of my being. But I remember viscerally feeling like an escort, or feeling like, oh, I have to sell myself now. You know, these myths, I mean, in the four-letter word sense, myth, small m myth, these myths about, you know, money and public appeal. And you know what? It's taken me some time to realize that really the sweet spot is being really good with the scholarly insights and being able to translate them to people in a practical way. And doing that is actually a strength in my view, not a weakness. So I'm glad you did.
Thank you. And there seems to be some synchronicity working here, since, you know, you didn't really know that that's how I started. Well, I started this particular book, I would say. My research would go back to 2010. The book I wrote very fast, you know, because Penguin wanted it. It's a commissioned piece of work. But the movies that we made, the videos that we made, they were sold worldwide in many countries. And this young person, this entrepreneur, he managed to build up a whole big business. And then he moved on to Ayurveda, which is definitely more sustainable than mythology, because we were not doing it to the academic world. It was out for anybody. You could be a truck driver. You could be a school teacher. You could be just a housewife, whatever you were. You may want to listen to stories about Ganesha. I did three films, Ganesha, Shiva, and the Goddesses. So the Goddesses was 5 hours long, Shiva was 5 hours, and Ganesha was 2.5 hours. So we did those, and out of those, the movie on Shiva, that's where this whole reluctant family man, you know, came about. Though I had been giving many talks over the years, and the title was always reluctant, because I always use this, reluctant family man. It seems to have resonated with my audiences, and so I use this title a lot. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Typically when I tell Puranic narratives, I either teach the narratives, or even if I'm not teaching the narratives, I may draw on them to elucidate a point about all things Indic. Yeah. But when sharing, talking about Shiva, I'll say, you know, Parvati is a saint, you know, Shiva doesn't text, he doesn't call for like 10,000 years. You know, it's like, every once in a while I'll say, you know, he's the kind of independent, avoidant boyfriend who doesn't call you back. This is Shiva. So the title, The Reluctant Family Man, it resonates, because it tells you something about the human experience, about behavior, right? About personality types. Obviously, in his case, he's not at the bar. He's getting drunk in other ways, but that's beside the point. You know, either way, Parvati's a saint. What's the structure of the book? Like, tell us a bit about what's inside the book.
Well, so what I did was, since this was going to be a book that I was going to talk a lot about my own experiences and the experience of people I've been talking to over the last few decades, I sort of like, made these, you know, I decided, you know, actually the young entrepreneur asked me, can you just tell me, you know, what were the principles by which you've led your life? How do you feel? You know, what are the main principles? Can you just give them to me? And so I sat and I told him, you know, I said things like focus. And then we look for the Sanskrit. We said, okay, ekagrata. I said, okay, ekagrata. Or, you know, like, you need to know your inner nature more than anything else. You know yourself. So swabhava. So I just did, I went about doing that, you know, and I believe for one's core being, it's important to have a strong relationship no matter who it's with. So then vasamarasa, you know, so I had these words in English, which I then translated into Sanskrit. And, you know, I said, okay, these are the words, and this is how I'm going to write the book. I'm going to divide them into these 5 chapters. And there's going to be an end goal. And that end goal is something which I read in the Upanishads, you know, when I was visiting OCHS, Oxford, on my first fellowship there. And I spent a lot of time with Vedantic scholars, and that's when I really got a full, you know, exposure to the Upanishads. And this whole concept and idea, punatva, it just struck me as being so beautiful. This whole idea of not feeling fragmented, this whole idea of trying to feel a wholesomeness in yourself. I sort of like said that that's going to be the end goal for all of us. And we're not going to have it steadily in our life, like Shiva never had it steadily in his life. It comes and goes. You feel punatva now, something that may happen tomorrow, and you will not feel the punatva, but you have to work towards getting back into that space of wholesomeness. So
wholesomeness, so or punatva is one of the, I'd say there's an introduction and there are six thematic chapters. Punatva is the last one. You've got one on ekagrata, you just mentioned, single focusedness, swabhava, nature. And like, what are the other themes?
Yes, so there's samarasa, where there's this equipoise, you know, the kind of feeling you'll have with somebody whom you're very close to, and, you know, the relationship, the whole relationship angle. And then there is the very important thing which Shiva needs in his life all the time, because he can be quite imbalanced at times, santulan, the whole idea of not going overboard and, you know, trying to maintain some kind of balance. And the fifth is actually my favorite, because that sort of like encapsulates what Shiva is. If you want to know exactly what he is, he is into and he believes and he needs Vairagya. So the whole idea of detaching yourself, you know. So that is something that I wrote a chapter. One chapter is on Vairagya. And then all five of these, if you use them properly in your life, with a whole lot of examples thrown in from life and from, you know, experiences and also mythology, then you will arrive at punatva. That is the kind of, you know, the kind of, what should I say, what I'm proclaiming a bit. It's a bit enthusiastic. I mean, it's a bit cheeky to be able to say that, but the publishers seem to like it. And it seems to have worked, Raj, because I've been getting a lot of feedback on this book.
Well, cheeky or not, don't the Shastras themselves say that? that there is a path to wholeness. Perhaps they don't flesh it out in modern English with examples from mythology of Shiva. But, you know, isn't that what we're all seeking in certain ways? Some element of wholeness. So, I mean, there's so many directions with which we can take this conversation. This methodology, right? This. I guess methodology is the best word for it. So just to flesh out for the audience, you are using examples, you are using narratives from the mythology of Shiva, and you're saying this exemplifies this quality or the significance of this or this theme. Would you say... how did this methodology come about for you? Like, where did this start up?
Okay, so, well, you know, my entire PhD, my PhD thesis was on Shiva. And that was such a long time ago, but that's when I started writing books on Shiva. And I went through quite a few of them. And, you know, some were just meant for academics, you know, where you look at inscriptions, you look at Purans, you look at art. So as I went along, I just felt that there was so much of richness in Shiva. That once you bring it down, I'm not saying dumb it down, but you bring it down without getting too into, you know, pedantic. So you don't get too much into all that. And you just simplify some of the stories or some of the aspects of iconography. I felt no matter which part of the world I went to give talks on Shiva, Parvati, Ganesha, that is the Shaivic, you know, pantheon, I found people, it resonated with people. People didn't feel that, oh, this is a Hindu god she's talking about, or they didn't feel it was sectarian at all. People laughed when they should have laughed. They didn't allow me to stop talking. I would sometimes have 40 minutes and I would go on for 2 hours. And it was just incredible the kind of reaction one got to these stories. So that's when I knew, Raj, that these stories will resonate with everybody. It doesn't matter. You don't have to be a Hindu. Yeah,
that is that is the power of myth, right? That's the real power, and it's so difficult to convey. There are these texts evidence a specific historical horizon or religious ethos, and that's very important. Right, they'll tell us much about ancient India, or with narratives, at very least imagined, the imaginaire of ancient India, without question. But the real power of the narratives, in my view, is that they tell us about ourselves. They tell us about humans. They tell us about life's big questions. And that need not be packaged. The coconut water can be had without the shell, yeah? It doesn't need to be packaged. You don't need to be espoused to a Brahmanical worldview or practice, for example, whether you are or not is not the point. And I find that there are these two extremes of looking at these narratives as sort of religious relics to be understood, or taking them as the gospel truth. And they're literally true, and the word myth is not even a word that we can use for these. And there are these two extremes quite often, and in my view, the most compelling and powerful use of these narratives is teasing away what pertains to us over the generations, over cultures. Like, what is it about the human experience that's being talked about? So would you give us an example or two of some of the stories you've used and how you've used them?
Yes, certainly. Well, you know, one advantage I have is I live in this culture. I live in India. And so many of the students whom I speak to, and I don't teach religion, I teach ancient Indian history. Religion is a very small part. But, you know, I specialize in the history of religion. So I continue to write and I speak on it, but I'm not as, you know, into it the way everyone else, because I teach history. But anyway, so the thing is that the people here are familiar, Raj, with some of the stories, but they will not necessarily know how we have interpreted them or how many ways they can be interpreted and how the artists, you know, the iconography or the artists, you know, contributing to the story. So for instance, when I'm talking about Ekagrata and I'm saying, you know, this one-minded focus that Shiva has the ability to have, you know, and which sort of like replenishes him each time he gets sort of like, you know, gets weakened by all the things that are happening around, you know, that kind of thing. You can see that happening in a myth like the Samudra Manthan, that is the churning of the ocean. And when the churning of the ocean is taking place, all the gods are running hither thither, and who do they eventually have to go to act almost like a savior is Shiva. And we talk about him being the destroyer, but he's actually the savior because he's sitting there meditating with all that wonderful meditative power that he's collected in within him, and he knows exactly what to do. He knows what solutions to provide to the world, to save the world, whether it is the swallowing of the kalkut, the poisonous smoke, whatever it is. It's not Vishnu, it's not Ram, it's not any of the other gods, it's Shiva who they all run. And of course, we know it's in the sectarian Purans that are dealing with Shiva. We know that all is there. The Vaishnava Purans.
Nevertheless, of course, this will evidence sectarianism. Of course, but there's more than that there. Shiva is the destroyer. He is destroying the most destructive force. It's the same with the myths of Durga, or the myths of the mother. She destroys the destructive. She destroys, right? Ultimately, that destructive role is transformative and benefic in some way. And so, of course, it makes sense they would use Shiva to neutralize the poison. Who else possibly could?
Yeah? That's right. Yeah.
Please, I interrupted. Please go ahead.
I can sense that you are getting excited because this is your field. And so you must be wanting to say so much. And please, Raj, feel free to say whatever you have. So, you know, when we're talking, for instance, about Samarasa, we're talking about the relationship between Shiva and Parvati. I mean, you started off by saying she was like a saint. I mean, she has so much. She's so gutsy. She's so autonomous. And what is so interesting is that within the whole marriage, the field of marriage, she's not an autonomous goddess when she's Parvati. When she's with Shiva, and the kind of quarrels they have, and the way she gives it back to him. I mean, I love to talk about that wonderful scene in which they're playing Chaucer, when she disrobes him, makes him take off everything, his Rudrakshmala, his crescent moon, his loincloth. I mean, she gives it back to him because all his cronies are sitting there, Narad and all are sitting there and saying that you are cheating and you're trying to cheat with someone who is invincible. And so you see the sectarian conflict going on between the Shaivite followers and the Parvati followers, because she was a great goddess before she was spoused, right? So, you know, when you talk about these, and then I remember the first lecture I gave in America after my first book was out, and there was a student there. This was in Western Michigan University in Ann Arbor. And there was a student there. He said, oh, I see, they play strip poker, you know, because she made them take off. She said, take off that loincloth. And he said, oh, your gods played strip poker. And I just stopped mid and I said, well, if you want it, in a manner of speaking. But she didn't allow him to take it off because better sense prevailed. The moment he saw that she was forcing him to do so. Look at Shiva. He's actually going to take it off. When she taunts him, she said, you're not scared of nudity. You go around everywhere nude. What about the Daruvan? In the Daruvan, in those forests, you went around and you seduced the ascetics, not the ascetics, the Vaishnavs, you know, Rishi's wives. And you're not scared of nudity. Take it off. And then better sense reveals. And she said, keep it on. I'm not going to make you take it off. But, you know, there's this relationship between the husband and the wife where it's a give and take. It's egalitarian. She has her point of view. She expresses it again and again and again. And so does he. I don't see that between Lakshmi and Vishnu, for instance. And I don't want to go into that field. But I'm just saying that look at Shiva and Parvati. Look at how their quarrels are so entertaining and so robust and so colorful. And that they make me feel glorious when I read about their relationship. Let me put it.
Lakshmi and Vishnu, it's a very different sort of archetypal relationship, and Lakshmi represents something, a very specific, narrow, rarefied band of the human experience. It's, you know, purified. There's so much I could say, but I won't, because what we'll say is that there's so much dynamism, obviously, between Shiva and Parvati, and the narratives are so colorful, so compelling. What's another aspect or tale of Shiva that you've used in the book?
Well, you know, when I was talking about Swarupa, you know, Swabhava, so, you know, I didn't actually have a story to tell, except that, you know, both his wife's parents were horrified at the way he tended to dress. So I like to talk about that he had his own personality. He didn't get taken in by the riches of other gods. He just was so simple all the time. He had, you know, a very, even his friends were, you know, all antinomian, so to say, and, you know, going against the grain. And I thought that outlandishness that Shiva represented to the society at that time when the Qurans were being written, I marvel at that. And I marvel at the fact that even to this day in India, people worship this Shiva when they see him in a tiger skin skirt, when they see him bare-chested, when they see him with jatamukunda, that is those snail-like hair, not combed, just, you know, unkempt, and everything about him. You know, it's this kind of, you know, the fact that these two things can exist. You can have him as a great Mahadeva, the greatest god, the god who was never born, the oldest god perhaps of this civilization. And yet you can have him with all these so-called antinomian, you know, kind of characteristics and attributes. And I find that fascinating that the Indian mind is able to accept.
Well, the narratives, I can't remember. I think I was saying in a tutorial earlier, maybe today, that some of the tropes you see in the Puranas and the Mahabharata, like, I don't know if they were drinking soma or what they were doing. they're endlessly gripping in ways that you can't imagine. And so, yes, I definitely resonate with how compelling these tales are. One of the key functions which make them compelling, but also can present barriers for exegesis, is that they intentionally preserve paradox. Folks don't get this. They're trying to make a decision. And no, the narrative is crafted to preserve the tension between the outer and the inner, or ascetic ideology Brahmanic ideology. Like, there, you know, clearly Shiva is, you know, he's this outcast, you know, yogi, shaman, like, you know, this uncool dude. He's always at the yoga studio. And then you have this high class family in Delhi bringing him home for tea. And they're like, what are you doing with him? And, well, he is following his Swabhava daddy.
What about in the crematorium, the cremation grounds? He's there as well. And he's got the ashes from the dead bodies all over him. Like, he besmears himself. So there are things which are really, like, in a way, if you think repellent or repugnant or whatever you want to hear. And there's so many sides to the Shiva that I just think that's why, you can see the paradoxical trait in my title, The Reluctant Family Man. He is reluctant because he's a renunciant. He does not want to get married. He has to get married for the sake of this universe, that he would have a child, would defeat the great demon Taraka, because, the goddess whom he's going to marry is powerful. He's powerful. So the whole idea behind it is to sort of like save the world in a way. And so he has to get married, even though he's reluctant. But he does not stop his trait of going away with his friends, going into the forest, going into the mountains, meditating, whether having Soma, Ras, whatever he's doing, long periods away from his wife, where she experiences deep loneliness. And we all know how, Ganesha was born out of that deep loneliness. So it seems like a very modern, a man who's spending too much of time in the bar or in the pubs or something. I mean, if you want to really look at it like that.
Well, listen, I don't think any culture has a license on AWOL men, I think this is something that is, and not all men, obviously. What I'm saying is that there is a strand. There's a strand of experience that is well encapsulated in this mountain man, this rough or shamanic figure who is Shiva. And in addition to, obviously, the myth makers drew on their own experiences. And obviously, the chances are very good that most of these texts were written by men, so they will potentially understood that impulse. Having said that, there's also this story of the integration of Shiva into the fold, the integration of this figure known as Shiva into the Vedic fold, who finally gets a share of the sacrifice, who finally gets a wife and a family. There's this beautiful sort of in the history of religions, you're seeing Shiva is integrated and now he's fully part of the Vedic sacrifice. But that wasn't always the way, because he was this, wild, drunken, or aloof aspirant. What's next? How will you further, whether you will or not, how will you further develop this work or strand or method?
Well, Raj, this is, I think, the third or fourth book on Shiva that I have written. And so I have a biography of Shiva as well. Before that, it's called Rudra, The Idea of Shiva, also brought out by Penguin. And so I've talked about Shiva at length through the eyes and through the thoughts of all these gods like Vishnu, Ganesha, Sati, Parvati. So, I've pretty much, I'm thinking, do I have something more to say about Shiva? Because it's been so much, the films are there, I've given so many talks. But let me see, once I finish what I'm doing right now, maybe I'll explore a little further and have a look at what else I can say about Shiva. But all I can say is that the stories are delightful. And it's not just the stories, I always like to bring in the iconography. The iconography is delightful. Whether you're seeing him in his Dakshinamurti form, or you're seeing him as Gauri Shankar, or you're seeing the Lingam, you're seeing the Chaturmukh, you're seeing the Panchmukh. Everything has to be explained. And what's wonderful is that there is a myth behind almost every iconographic type. And so I really like the fact that we can bring in the art as well. And for me, it's so interesting because he's a flourishing god in India even today. So it's not something that I'm talking about, something in the past. It's not something that people don't know a little bit about. They just get more. They get, they learn more because, as you know, we don't have religious studies as such in India. Sadly enough, we don't have that. So even if I were to, maybe one day when I retire, I'll try doing something more on a larger scale, just with the history of religion. But right now I teach history. I have a very good job in the university. I have to fulfill that. But so people don't get to know what our academics actually saying about all these things. So I really feel nice that I feel happy that I have this opportunity to put across some of the theories of what academics are saying in a way that will appeal to all the people. I mean, I like to have this bridge between the public and the academia. It's very nice to bridge this gap. And I always feel that they're so intelligent. I get wonderful letters from people who are in other fields, who are engineers, who are architects, and who have liked the books and write back to me. And right now during the pandemic, I have heard from quite a few people that this book has given them a lot of solace, especially when they have lost family members to the disease. And they have actually written to me and told me, thank you for the book. We're reading it for the second time. And the chapter on Vairagya or the chapter on Ekagrata is really helping us. So I feel very happy that I've written a book that is appealing to people in this time of need, Raj.
Well, it's deeply fulfilling. It's deeply fulfilling to draw on the power of myth as a salve for these troubled times. That's profoundly fulfilling, I imagine. One thought that comes to mind is that's the what you just described about making available the fruit of scholarly labor to a wider public. That very much is the foundational impulse behind the New Books Network. The whole conglomeration of podcasts. There are a number of channels. Mine pertains to books on, it used to be called Hindu Studies. It's now Indian Religions, to make room for example, Sikhism, Jainism, Islam and Christianity in India. Yeah. But there are channels in the New Books Network on history, philosophy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why it resonates, because that impulse to bridge, you know, what we do as scholars in terms of the production and the advancement of human knowledge and everyday life. So that is the podcast. There are specialists who listen. Indeed, the majority of the people who listen are people who are just interested in knowing what scholars are coming up with, or interested in a field of study. And more and more that you mentioned OCHS in passing. That's one of the things I love about being involved in the continuing studies department there. It's a good bridge between knowledge production and public interest. Was there anything else about the book that you wanted to share before we close today?
So it was something that I didn't think would happen. I mean, I didn't think that any serious or any good publishing house would want to do it. I'm just glad that they were interested. I'm glad that they did such sharp editing, in the sense that I didn't ever become too wordy or too, you know, like too much of jargon in it. It was just the right amount so that any intelligent person can pick up the book and read it. They helped me a lot through that whole process. Since it was out, you know, in 2019, March 2019. Since then, there have been people who have been read it and come back. And it's actually my first audiobook. It's been made into an audiobook. So that's another thing I'm excited about, that people will be able to drive in their cars, or people will be able to go for walks and be able to, you know, listen to the book. So all I have to say is that it is a book that is, you know, perhaps providing a path to those people who need it. It's not for everyone. There might be people who feel they're very evolved and they really don't, you know, need to pick up a book like this. But I have found that whether it is teenagers, people at the, you know, age group of 19, or whether it is a person who's 60 years old. In fact, I was asking the other day a person who's in her 60s, and I said, why did you like the book? So she said, you know, there's some things that we may have done in our past when we were younger. And this gives us a perspective on it. Because each time I've analyzed a myth, I've sort of like related it to our everyday life, you know, what people may be going through in their partnerships, their marriages, for instance, that's in Samarasa. Or when somebody dies, so how do you manage to detach yourself from that eventually? What did Shiva do when Sati died? So, you know, just to show how Shiva was a bawling, you know, crying his eyes out, man, he's supposed to be this macho, virile god, but at the same time, look at the kind of tenderness you see when you see him dying, you know, crying after you know, absolutely uncontrollably after his first wife, Sati, dies. It's, you know, it's amazing to see those, you know, descriptions. So, you know, and how he deals with it, and how Vishnu comes and helps him, and how he knows he has to detach himself from all that. So, you know, these, I try to take out lessons from these myths. And I think that is something that when people read it, I hope that they get an idea, those who don't know much about it. Those who do know, I hope they can see another perspective and they can see my own interpretation. There's a lot of me, I have to say, in the book, because they did want me to talk about experiences of people I know, or, you know, what I may have experienced myself. So it's a combination of the mythology. There's not much history. I've not included too much history, but there is some art. There is some mythology. There's a lot of mythology, and there's a lot of experiences. And so the readings come from the Upanishads. They come from the Purans. They come a lot from, even from some very colorful, wonderful inscriptions that I read when I was doing my PhD. I have sort of like taken material from different places, Raj. And that's all I want to say about the book. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. And thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Raj. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed myself. I've met a fellow traveler who is doing the same thing. And all the best to you. All the best to you in your endeavor.
Thank you. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Nilima Ajit-Gopekar, who's associate professor at Delhi University, on her new Penguin Books publication, The Reluctant Family Man, Shiva in Everyday Life. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the power of myth. Take care.